Blog Talk Radio.
It is a marvelous Monday. Welcome to Markman Madness on Blog Talk Radio, driven by Mancini Media. Our producer is Mark Mancini. I'm Mark Heffernan, Mark Mann, not just one. And you can get in touch with me by going to my email site, that is sportsrapnet at yahoo.com, sportsrapnet at yahoo.com, or markheff20 at gmail.com, markheff20 at gmail.com. Hopefully, we will hear from Tom Hewitt in about 10 minutes. He was on briefly last week. He is a former Portland State broadcaster, now doing public address in Arizona. He's basically retired. Also was a teacher, and we really didn't get a chance to get into all of the things that he has done or does last week. So he's scheduled for today. As of right now, he is finishing up doing public address for a high school softball game in Arizona. And I think his team is down 12-0. Now, if they continue to be down 10 runs or more, that game will be called after 5 innings. But, of course, I don't know for sure. Right now the game's in the 5th inning, and his school is down 12-0. I heard about this maybe 20 minutes prior to the show, but nevertheless, it's spontaneous, Mark. Mark Heffernan with you once again. Okay. Well, you know, Thursday, L.A. Dodgers catcher Will Smith was booed for having the same name as the actor who slapped comic Chris Rock at the Oscars before resigning from the Academy. Well, Major League Baseball Will Smith tripled the guy who plays for the Dodgers. Remember a few years ago, the Giants, their closer was Will Smith. Now he's pitching for another team. Mark Mancini probably knows who he is. So one time, a couple of times that year, Will Smith, the Dodgers catcher, faced Will Smith, the Giants pitcher. And that was, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago, which was pretty amazing. Yesterday in the NBA, Nuggets 129, the Lakers 118, the 6th consecutive loss for the Lake Show. They're not really much of a show. They don't run enough. They don't shoot threes, and they lose a lot. Clippers 119, Pelicans 100. Remember, the Pelicans beat the Lakers going to the weekend. That was a must win for the Lakers. Had a big lead throughout, and then they just couldn't make shots in the fourth quarter. As usual, didn't play much defense down the stretch. LeBron scored 38 in the game, but only 2 points, 2 in the fourth quarter on 1 layup when he came back to the game with 6 minutes left. AD had 23 points and double-digit rebounds. Westbrook had 27, but nevertheless, another loss. Warriors 109, Kings 90. Remember, they're playing without Steph Curry. Dallas 118, the Bucks 112. Big game for Luka, who's an MVP candidate. And Philadelphia 112 and Cleveland 108. NBA standings. Miami Heat have kind of, I guess they're riding the ship. They had some internal problems and problems on the court there for a while. And everybody else had caught up to them in the NBA Eastern Conference. Now they stand alone at 51-28. Celtics are 49-30. And tied are the Bucks and the 76ers. In the West, Suns, even though they lost without D-Book or Ayton yesterday, they are 62-16, the best record in basketball. Grizzlies, number 2 in the West, at 55-23, followed by the Dubs in 29, then Dallas at number 4, 49-30, just one game back of Golden State. Now, I don't agree with Magic Johnson, Laker great, that the Lakers should keep Anthony Davis, LeBron, and Russell Westbrook next year. It's not working. He made a comment on a show on ESPN today that it's not working. So if it's not working, why do you keep everybody? Trade these guys while they still have some trade value. You should be able to get at least 2 players for any one of those dudes, AD, LeBron, or Westbrook. And I don't mean getting a 35-year-old has-been. I mean getting a pretty good player or two, or get 1 player plus a draft pick. Lakers don't have any good draft picks. They need to get younger. They need to get guys that can shoot threes. Better than 25%. The game has changed since the Lakers won 2 years ago. You had AD, they had LeBron during 2020, the bubble year, and they played pretty good defense. Well, the defense is not the same as it was 2 years ago. They got rid of some of the younger guys, some of the guards. Plus, LeBron and AD are older. They're getting hurt more often. They don't run the court as well. And the other players they got, except for Malik Monk, and Austin Reeves is a rookie. Other players are older veterans that used to be good, but are only good by name only now. Name only. They're not good on the court. They got to make a change to that team. I think Frank Vogel goes, but he's not solely responsible for their problems this year. Remember one time the Lakers looked out as a favorite for the NBA championship. They probably won't make the play-in game. They're two games back with three to go. Amazing. Amazing. Okay. At any rate, I'm not sure what they should do, but looking at maybe Gilgeous Alexander from OKC or Jeremy Grant from Detroit, a couple of guys in their 20s that are very good ball players. They need to get younger, and they need to get better. I'm not so much talking about being an NBA championship contender. I'm just talking about being a better team. Now, the Lakers talk about, well, it's NBA championship or bust. They're not even close to being an NBA championship contender. So I'm going to make a play-in game. You don't have to be number 10 seed to make the play-in game. Really? You have LeBron and AD in your team? Yeah, I know they were hurt, but even when they play together, they don't win very much. They're not good in the clutch in the fourth quarter. They were 2 years ago. They're not good now. I'm talking about what's going on now, not what happened 2 years ago, not what happened 3 years ago. LeBron's had a very good statistical year, yes, stat-wise, but for some reason, either he gets tired or he's not a closer, he doesn't play well in the fourth quarter. I would like to know his shooting percentage in the fourth quarter or his shooting percentage in the last 5 minutes of a game, and I would also like to know his free throw percentage in the fourth quarter and or his FT percentage in the last 5 minutes of a game. There's been about 12 to 14 games this year that were winnable games for the Lakers. LeBron was playing. It was, you know, one anywhere from 1 to 3 points. Either they're up by 1 or 3 or down by 1 or 3. Winnable games in the last 4 or 5 minutes. And the fact is they came up short every time. I think LeBron is 0 for 13. No field goals made out of 13 tries at the conclusion of a game or the last few seconds. In other words, taking a shot either to win a game or to tie a game, something like that. Not good. Okay, Los Angeles Rams, Thursday, April 18th. OTAs off season. They begin May 23rd and 24th. Also have them on May 26th, May 31st through June 2nd. Mandatory minicamp is June 7th through the 9th. Phase 1 consists of meetings and weight room training. Phase 2 consists of on-field work, but individual and group, but no hitting, not in pads, basically. Phase 3, no tackling or contact. Those either 7-on-7 drills, 9-on-9, or 11-on-11. OTAs for the Los Angeles Rams. Mancini doesn't like to hear that. The Los Angeles Rams, the Super Bowl champions, finally in L.A., twice as the Rams organization. And 3 times the Rams organization has won the NFL title, once in Cleveland. Okay, so I get that straight. Congratulations to Dawn Staley, winning her second NCAA women's basketball title. She was a great player. Number 1 South Carolina beat number 2 UConn 64-49 yesterday. Gamecocks finished at 35-2, Huskies 30-6, second championship, wire-to-wire number 1 for South Carolina. They were number 1 in October and number 1 as of yesterday. Okay, Boston, 11 points, 16 rebounds. She missed a shot last year that would have won it for South Carolina. She didn't score that well, but she rebounded, had 16. Henderson, the guard, 26 points, 4 assists for South Carolina. Congratulations to them. UConn, that was their first loss in a title game under Geno. They won 11 championships. That was the 12th final appearance and the first loss. Pretty great stuff he's done over there. Okay. Of course, tonight, it's number one Kansas against UNC. North Carolina was number 8 seed in their particular region. Kansas was number 1, and they're playing for the men's basketball final. And the final four the other day, it was Kansas 81 and Villanova 65. One of the top players for Nova was not playing because he had an Achilles tendon injury. And that played a part. Kansas is a very deep team, very fast, like to take it to the hole, and they can shoot the threes. Now, UNC likes to shoot threes, and they make a lot of them, especially in the fourth quarter by Caleb Love. They were 81, Duke 77. And so unfortunately, Krzyzewski's first loss, I think it was his first loss as head coach at Duke. Our first loss at home was to North Carolina. His final regular season home loss was to North Carolina. And his final loss as the head coach, after winning 5 NCAA titles, was to North Carolina, his number one rival. So not too cool right here for him. 12, softball. UCLA, the Lady Bruins. They won 24 consecutive games. They're now 41-3, 9-0 in the Pac-12, as they swept Oregon 4-2, winning. UCLA is number 3 in the country. Oregon's number 12. Savannah Pola had a 3-run shot for the Lady Bruins. Pac-12 baseball, Arizona 9-3 and 21-7. UCLA 6-3, 19-8. Oregon State 7-5 and 20-7. And Oregon 7-5 and 18-10. Now, UCLA had a tough series with Oregon baseball. All 3 one-run games, 3-2, 4-3, and 5-4. April 5th, Alma Marymount playing at UCLA. April 8th through the 10th, UCLA is at Utah. Big West Conference baseball, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, or San Luis Obispo, and Cal State Bakersfield both at 5-1. UCSB, Santa Barbara 7-2, and Irvine 6-3. San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly, they're 18-10 overall, but Cal State Bakersfield is 12-14. Wow. Mount West Conference baseball, UNLV 11-1 and 19-9. Nevada 7-4 and 13-13. And Fresno State, those Dogs, 7-5 and 13-14. Well, he has finished his softball game, his duties. I guess it was one of those 10-run rules. Tom Hewitt, welcome to Markman Madness. How are you?
Hey, good, Mark. Good to be here. Yeah, it was one of those 12-run rules. Actually, the two top teams in the state of Arizona, Xavier Prep versus Hamilton High School, but the home team, the Huskies, who beat them twice last year when they were ranked number one, couldn't get it done today and lost 12-0.
Well, you said there were two of the top teams in Arizona. Why was the score so lopsided? 12-0?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, they were just, I think the fact that they beat them twice last year, Hamilton did, that was their only two losses of the year, and they ended up winning the state championship, Xavier did, so they had a little revenge in mind.
How many home runs were hit today, Tom?
There were 3, I believe. Yeah, these girls are so strong now. The wind tends to blow out here, and I really think they need to move the fences back a little bit because the game has changed so much with the training that the girls go through and the strength and the technique that they have. It's a different game than it was 20 and 30 years ago, but everybody likes the long ball, so I don't think it's going to change.
Is the maximum 250 feet to center field, or is that in college?
I think that's in college because these are pretty much 200 down the lines, and I think maybe 220 to center. Yeah.
That's not too far, but, you know, sometimes it's kind of hard to hit those girls where they pitch. You know, they have a lot of velocity at a very close range, and some of them have that great drop ball and changeup, so they mix it up very well, and you don't have a lot of time to react as a batter.
Yeah, that's the thing that's kind of surprised me, and this is the second year I've done it, and I haven't seen that lights-out pitcher that I expected. So it is, you know, a pitcher can dominate women's softball. There's no doubt about that. But it's been more of a hitting game, the games that I've seen. And these, you know, the way they do it in Arizona is they take all the best teams and basically put them in the same league. So these are the best players and the best teams in Arizona. And many, many of these girls are going Division I.
Have you seen many pitchers wear helmets this year? You know, thin helmets?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't seen helmets as much. I've seen a lot of masks. Helmets.
Right.
Yeah, they wear masks. Most of them do because it, you know, boy, like I said, the strength and the timing that these girls have, that mound is not too far away when you finish that pitch.
Let me ask you this. If you were pitching to these girls, would you be wearing a mask?
Yeah, I probably would. Although I got
sometimes
a face for radio,
so
it might not matter. Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Well, Tom, we didn't talk a lot last week about your play-by-play at Portland State. You were there for many years. I wanted to ask you about the Vikings. What league do they compete in? And what were some of your highs and some lows doing play-by-play at Portland State?
Well, Portland State's in the Big Sky Conference, and it was there for 20 years, and all of them were in in the Big Sky. And, of course, you know, the Highs were winning it in winning the Big Sky tournament in 2008, which we actually hosted at what was then the Rose Garden, and won that year. And then the next year was probably a big high, was winning at Weber State. We didn't actually play Weber. We played against Montana State. But Julius Thomas, who went on to be a outstanding tight end, a great story. I think I called 125 of his basketball games, and he hadn't played football since he was a ninth grader. And after his senior year of basketball, he came out for football the next year and slowly worked his way into it. By the end of the year, he was an outstanding tight end in our conference, and then went to the NFL, struggled with some injuries, but got himself healthy, and Peyton Manning found him as his favorite target that one year for 13 touchdowns and made Julius a couple million dollars. So that was a big highlight. You know, there's really nothing low about it, except for probably one time when I was calling play-by-play and doing the traveling motion on the scorer's table there, nearly got thrown out of the game by the referee for that. But, you know, it was – games are always fun. I coached before I did play-by-play, and every game you go into, no matter how much of a lopsided situation it might be, as a coach, you always think you can win, and you kind of feel the same way as a broadcaster. So very exciting, and football Saturdays are always really special.
How did you almost get thrown out of a game as an announcer?
Well, I was over my head. I was doing the traveling motion every time their post player got the ball and traveled in the post, and the official came over to me and used some expletives and say, if I see those hands in that motion one more time, you're going to be gone. So the hands were down on my waist after that.
So you were doing play-by-play and not PA at that time?
Yeah, I did play-by-play all at Portland State. A couple of years at Oregon State, I was like the number two guy, filled in. Big highlight there was probably a guy, Corey Benjamin, who played about five years in the NBA, came down to Arizona State here and had 36 points. And the fun thing about it, I remember I had a tape of the game, and he had a couple spectacular dunks, and he came up to my room after, and even as a college kid, wanted me to replay those dunk shots for him because he wanted to hear them. So Corey was a great player for us, and that was a great opportunity to get started after doing 6 years of high school play-by-play.
I guess you got a little bit animated as a play-by-play broadcaster, right? Moving the hand motions and everything like that?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it, yeah. The AD used to go to the league meetings, and whenever they started talking about announcers, he'd raise his hand and say, well, I know you're talking about my guy. So, yeah, as a guy who played college basketball and college baseball and then coached, I took a lot of that into the broadcast booth. But the home fans liked it, the visiting fans not as much.
Where did you play college basketball and baseball?
I played at George Fox University in Oregon, NAI school. I grew up in Seattle and was a ball boy for the Sonics from 68 to 73, so I go way back. I remember the night that D.B. Cooper took all that money and jumped out of that airplane. I was in the world champion Lakers locker room, and Wilt Chamberlain thought he was the greatest guy he'd ever heard of because he ripped off the system for all that money. So great memories of being in the Knicks locker room in 70 and 73 when they were champions, and the Lakers in 72. I remember sitting on the end of the bench talking to Jerry West after the Lakers were blowing out the Sonics. He was always very cordial and talked to us little ball boys in the day. So it was quite an experience growing up.
Tom Hewitt is my guest on Markman Madness here on Blog Talk Radio, driven by Mancini Media. Our number 347-205-9631, 347-205-9631. Tom, is it warm in Arizona today?
Yeah, it's not bad. We haven't really hit that hot stretch yet. It's about 87 degrees and a nice breeze, but it's going to get into the 90s for the next 5 days, but fortunately it's going to go back to the 70s. For at least a few days after that, because it seems like once we hit that 100 mark, you can pretty much just chalk it in until about October 15th.
Isn't your wife originally from Oregon, so she's used to the cool weather?
She's used to the cool weather, and summers aren't her favorite thing down here, but you find a way to make it through.
How long have you lived in Arizona?
Yeah, it'll be 5 years coming up July 4th, yeah.
Do you play any golf?
Yeah, I live on a golf course. Play four or five times a week. Yeah, play tennis.
There are a lot of golf courses
a week
there in Arizona, aren't there? A lot of beautiful golf courses there.
Oh, yeah, there really are. We live in one of those old people's communities, so we have 45 holes that I belong to and two different courses right across the street from each other. So it's a great deal. And in the summer, you know, you get off the course by 11, and I can't say I've ever been out there and thought, oh, this is horrible. The last few holes, you know, it's about time to get back home, but it's wonderful for golf, no doubt about that.
You mentioned you served 10 years as a high school and college basketball head coach. What did you learn as a coach that you brought to the broadcast table?
Oh, that's an interesting thing. Well, I mean, I just think the strategies that would come up. I did play-by-play by myself, so I always looked at myself first as calling the play, and then when there were breaks in the play or at the free throw line, then I would put a different hat on and become an analyst and try and use the things that I had learned in coaching and the things that I see the other coaches doing to bring that part of the game to it. So that was a lot of fun because you got to really use the basketball knowledge you have. And, you know, a lot of that came from being ball boy for the Sonics. You know, for over 200 games, you sat there in NBA coaches' huddles and listened to everything they said and pregame talks and halftime talks. So yeah, it was quite an education into coaching early.
How many players in the NBA actually listen to their coaches during timeouts?
Well, it was interesting back in the day. One of the great stories, Cotton Fitzsimmons was going off in a pregame talk, and he would actually, it was a halftime talk, excuse me. He'd take a drink of a beer and then go into a rage and take the beer and throw it against the wall and have it explode. And he did that for about four beers. And
I love it.
Then he left the locker room, and most of the players on that Atlanta Hawk team just kind of said, well, think of the expletive to that guy. We don't really care what he says. So it was wild. As you know, in the 70s, particularly as we turned to 1970, things started to change, and there was a lot of crazy stuff that happened. So, you know, now the thing that I really noticed is we tend to put down the modern players and that type of thing, but the guys on the benches in the NBA are way more engaged in the game than they used to be back in that era. I mean, you see all the different signals they have when guys hit three-pointers and all the excitement they have for their teammates. And you know, there was a lot of brooding going on back in my era with guys that weren't playing. They were not that excited because they probably thought they should have been playing.
You know, way back in the day, you saw Texas Western lose their only game of the season in 1966 when they won the NCAA championship. Texas Western became UTEP. Tell me about that team and why it was so significant, and talk about the coach.
Well, that was really memorable for me. And the first thing about Don Haskins, I had a chance to broadcast a game when Portland State played at UTEP. And it was really in the last couple of years of Coach Haskins' life, and he was in a wheelchair at the time. And I came up to him and you know, kind of told him the story that I saw the only game that they lost that year to Seattle U. I remember Tom Workman, who played a few years in the NBA, kind of a journeyman, hit a 17-foot jumper to beat him on the buzzer. And, again, Coach Haskins had some expletives, and he said, well, that Seattle U team was probably better than Kentucky that they played in the championship game, which is a very memorable game because of the all-white Kentucky team against the all-black Texas Western team. The movie that was done kind of didn't do Seattle U fair because I think four of Seattle U's top six players were African-American, and the movie kind of made it like they were – you know, some team up in Alaska with a bunch of white guys, which really wasn't the case. The interesting thing about that year, Seattle U beat the NIT champ, and the NIT was much bigger than BYU, and they beat the NC2A champ, but didn't make the tournament. They won 17 games as an independent, and that wasn't good enough because they had a lot less teams in the tournament. But, yeah, I remember the players, Bobby Joe Hill and Willie Worsley and Neville Shedd and Big Daddy Latin, and it was just quite a team. Seattle U played them twice a year. So as a kid that was just fanatical about basketball, I kind of got to know that team before they made their great moment there in Washington, D.C., or actually University of Maryland, when they won the national championship.
Were they the first college basketball team in the South to have an all-African-American starting lineup?
Yeah, there's no doubt that they were. I mean, they were so far ahead of the curve at that time because – You know, you remember Maravich played 68, 69, and 70 in the Southeastern Conference, and there wasn't a black player in the Southeastern Conference. So that was really unique, and that's probably one of my other great stories is being a – Maravich was my idol, no doubt about it, and getting a chance to see him come to the Seattle Center Coliseum on a rainy January night in 1970 was just thrilling for a 15-year-old at the time. To rebound for the pistol, I remember I was so nervous making sure that I would make a good pass and throw it where he wanted it. It was really exciting.
How did Pistol Pete Maravich compare to some of the players today?
Well, you know, I think his game was far ahead of the time, and the fact that he was playing without the three-point line and still hitting shots that would have been three-point shots, and he would have just been a massive success, I think, in any era, and even more of a success now with the way the game is played and the court is spread. It just opens up so many opportunities because he was a great driver and a great passer of the basketball also. You just wish he could have played with the three-point line. Of course, he had the chance to do it and probably signed for more money in the ABA, but, you know, at that time, a lot of guys wanted to play in what was the best league at the point, which was the NBA.
He would have been great in the ABA with Dr. J. Think about him. Didn't he average over 50 points a game in college in back-to-back seasons?
Yeah. All 3 years, he averaged somewhere, I think, 43-8, 44-1, and maybe 44-5 in his 3 years. And, you know, Dr. J was with the Atlanta Hawks for a brief period of time when Maravich was there, and then some kind of judgment came down from the court system and said he couldn't leave his contract with the Virginia Squires. So it's an interesting story to look up. There's some reports on it on YouTube that they could have had the doctor and the pistol at the same time in Atlanta.
That would have been incredible.
Yeah, that would have been fun to see.
Who do you like in tonight's game? Who do you like in tonight's game between Kansas and North Carolina?
Well, I think you got North Carolina with the momentum kind of coming out of nowhere and building themselves to the point there. It's always scary. But, you know, the game, people make it complicated, but it especially with the three-point line, it comes down pretty simply, and especially for this North Carolina team. If you're making your three-point shots and getting plays where you're getting guys open, then it could be a big upset in a North Carolina national championship. And again, if they're not making them, they're pretty dependent on that to be the successful team that they've been of late, then Kansas is probably going to win the game. So I don't know where basketball would be. I think you have to have a three-point line and you have to have a shot clock, but it's surely a different game than when Kentucky and Texas Western played for the championship in 66.
Well, North Carolina shoots a lot of threes. They always do. And the thing about them, Kansas can beat them if they contain that Caleb Love. He's really been playing great in the tournament. The guard, number four, had 28 points last game against UCLA and against Duke. He was very quiet in the first half. He drove to the basket, got some space. Both games knocked down about two threes in a row, and then he got rolling. And that guy is a phenomenal player. Now, he only averages 16 points a game during the season. His shooting percentage is only about 38%, but he seems very good in the clutch. He's not afraid to take big-time shots. And then against UCLA, against Duke, he dominated both games in the second half. He couldn't miss.
Yeah,
from distance to the basket, kind of hang, throws it up. I mean, a guy with a lot of talent. He's a sophomore, but I think he'll be going to the NBA. But that's the whole thing. Can you contain him in the last 10 minutes of a game with your Kansas?
Yeah, that's the chess match that's taking place. And when you get from Saturday until Monday to prepare for the game, you know Kansas is going to have a game plan for that. And, of course, I think North Carolina's coaching staff is going to be telling him, hey, let's be aggressive from the get-go. It's only 40 minutes, you know, and the North Carolina guys are going to play the whole time, but 40 minutes of college basketball is nothing for a kid that age. I remember playing in a four overtime game and not really thinking anything of it. So it'd be interesting to see how aggressive he is from the get-go and then how Kansas' game plan goes from there. And then, again, do the first couple shots go down? If they do, look out.
Well, Baycott's been a rebounding machine for North Carolina. He's had two games over 20 rebounds. He's not a big-time scorer, the 6'10 center, but he's a ferocious rebounder. and is very long. And so he fouled out the last game, had an ankle problem, and then continued to play the last minute or so. So he's a key. I think Kansas is deeper. That doesn't mean they're going to win the game, but I think they have more quality players in their team. North Carolina relies on two or three players, but they've come a long ways for a number eight seed. And obviously, you get into the finals, anybody can win.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And again, you got two of the blue bloods playing each other. So, you know, some people are turned off by that. Other people like to see the best finishing at the end. But nobody in December thought that North Carolina would be here. So they definitely have a lot of momentum. And Kansas always up there. We played them the first game of the tournament in 08 when I was there. So I got a chance to see that up close and personal. And Bill Self is a guy that I really respect. But, boy, what a job Hubert Davis has done in his first year at North Carolina, taking over for a legend. And, you know, we've seen it in Portland, particularly at the University of Portland, with ex-NBA players who have just not been very good college coaches. So kudos to Hubert Davis for what he's done to bring the Tar Heels back to the top and maybe to the pinnacle if they can win tonight.
Well, remember, Jerry West and Magic Johnson were great players. They did not do well as head coaches in the NBA. I think it's very tough for a great player to be an outstanding coach for some reason.
Yeah, I think, you know, Jerry West, you know, I think it was patience with him. He just had a hard time understanding players who weren't as driven as he was and as fundamental as he was. I remember the Blazers took them out in that 77 championship year, and Jerry found it much better to be a little bit away from it as a general manager than in the trenches as a head coach.
Tom Hewitt is my guest on MMM. Who is the craziest person you've ever worked with on the air?
Well, not worked with, but a guy named Mike Rice, who was a long-time TV analyst for the Blazers, he was pretty crazy as a thrown out of one NBA game. And Mike, who coached at Duquesne and Dayton, I believe, long time with the Blazers, he was probably as nuts on the air as anybody I've seen.
Wow.
I mean, I usually worked alone. So, you know, except in football, I had a color man. But in basketball, I was always alone. And, I love that because as a kid, I always kept stats in every game in my spiral notebook and that type of thing. I remember keeping stats in a spiral notebook when Maravich had 64 against Kentucky and Issel had 50 in that game. I only saw Maravich play on TV two times during his college career, that game and then a loss in the NIT tournament. They lost to Marquette. So it was different, the college basketball. Even as big of a star as he was, the television coverage was so much different back then.
Tom Hewitt, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, Professor Twine Time at yahoo.com. And yeah, that's the one. I probably won't give out the phone number, but
okay.
Anybody wants to email me. As you can see, I love talking basketball, and I've got a pretty long history with the game.
Hey, Tom, thanks a lot for being on Markman Madness. I'm glad you could share your story with us.
Hey, Mark, I'm really glad that I was able to make it. Sorry about the little mix-up, but it all worked out great. All right.
It always
thanks,
does. Thanks a lot, Tom. Take care, man.
Okay.
You're listening to Markman Madness here on Blog Talk Radio, driven by Mancini Media. Our producer is Mr. Pittsburgh, Mark Mancini. Doesn't have the beard these days. I'm Mark Heffernan. My email site, sportswrapnet@yahoo.com or markheff20@gmail.com. Our number, 347-205-9631, 347-205-9631. We go to Oregon, Banks, Oregon. Mr. Trevor Beard, what's up?
Hey, not much. Just you asked me to be on a little while
yes,
ago,
sir.
So
thanks, man.
Kind of short notice, but yeah, always
hey,
always glad to talk sports and yeah.
Trevor, you're a basketball guy, and so I want to ask you, who do you like tonight between Kansas and North Carolina?
Well, as a lifelong basketball fan, I've always rooted for the underdog, unless it's my regional team being the Blazers. North Carolina's the underdog is the 8th seed, but I have family connections to Kansas. I've been to Kansas. I any other team playing against Kansas, I mean, I would root for Kansas for sure, but as a fan, it's kind of a toss-up because I'd like to see North Carolina win as the underdog, but having connections to Kansas, probably one of my favorite college basketball teams outside of Oregon, I would have to personally root for Kansas, but I would like to see a close game similar to the Duke game over the weekend that in Coach K's final game.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Bill Self's been a great coach for a long time. He's a Hall of Famer. Coached at Tulsa, I think Illinois, and now at Kansas. Do you realize he's only won one NCAA championship? Now, he's had a lot of chances. He struggled in the Final Four, I think, and in finals in his career. I'm not saying the monkey's on his back. This is a great opportunity for him to win number two, Bill Self. He's won a lot of games, it's tough to win a championship. And Hubert Davis, this is his first year as head coach at UNC. We know that Krzyzewski won five, but he was in 13 Final Fours. We know that Jay Wright has won two, and he won two the last 5 years. But I thought Self had won at least two titles, and I was going researching things last week. I couldn't believe he's won only once, and that was about 14 years ago. And he's had some quality teams, so you know that he wants this badly.
Yeah, the thing about Kansas, though, is I think Kansas had a lot better teams back in the 80s with Larry Brown back when Danny Manning played. And
uh-huh.
You think about some of the big names that came out of Kansas back in the 80s. I think those were probably better teams than Kansas now. But the NBA was a lot different type of game than it is now, too, which kind of reminds me of Tom Hewitt, the guy you had on before me. I'm familiar with him from Portland State, and he mentioned Mike Rice, and Mike Rice was a longtime analyst for the Blazers, and I remember that game that Tom said that Mike got through out of. That was during the 92 finals, back when the LA riots were going on. The game he got thrown out of was actually held at Thomas and Mack, because they had moved the game from L.A. to Las Vegas because of the riots, and that was the 92 NBA Finals.
Well, you talk about Kansas. McCormick had a big game the other day. He had 25 points on 10 of 12 shooting and 9 rebounds. He's 6'10", 250. Agbaji, I think, is maybe the best player. 21 points in the game. He's 6'5", 215, 6 of 8 shooting. Wilson had 12 rebounds and 10 points. Braun had 10 points and 3 rebounds for Kansas. Kansas is a very deep team. I think they have more depth than UNC, but UNC has a player named Caleb Love who's very good in the clutch. And not even shooting 40% for the year, but dynamite in the second half and down the stretch against UCLA and also against Duke. Caleb had 28 points the other day, 11 of 20 shooting, 4 rebounds. The other guard, Davis, had 18 and 7 rebounds. Manek, the redhead, who looks like Justin Turner, what a pickup he's been, a graduate player for UNC, 14 points, 4 rebounds. And then Baycott, the center, once again had, I think he had 11 points and 21 rebounds. The second game, he's had over 20 boards. Baycott, he's 6'10", 240. So the team's seen a matchup at center, you know, with guys at the same height, and both teams have 6'4 and 6'5 guards. Looks like a good matchup. And as you said, maybe Kansas had more quality individual players in the past. Maybe today's team has more depth, more players that can play. The game's changed a little bit. UNC likes to shoot threes. When they get hot with their threes, watch out. They're going to shoot a lot of threes, regardless of whether they make them or not. And think about them. Can they be hot throughout the game, and how will they be in the last 6 or 7 minutes? Will they make the threes or not? Because we know they're going to shoot a lot of threes. And if Caleb Love gets going, watch out. Kansas has to find a way to contain him. Because in those two games last week and against UCLA, he was very quiet in the first half. He was kind of driving, not doing a lot. Then he knocked down a couple threes, and there he went. He just, like, took off. He could shoot threes, take the ball to the basket. He hangs, puts it in, 82% free throw shooter. Seemed like he's kind of the key for UNC in the game tonight.
Yeah, I think North Carolina is probably going to have to shoot around 40%. from three-point range to try to beat Kansas. That game that Villanova beat Houston to get to the Final Four, Houston only shot like 8% or something, so that's definitely not going to win you too many games. But if North Carolina gets in foul trouble or has any issues with injuries, their depth, I think, is going to hurt them against Kansas having a big bench.
So look at the NBA. It looks like the Heat have kind of righted the ship. They had some internal problems and other things going on a couple of weeks ago. Right now, two games and a loss column better than the Celtics and Bucks, with only about three left. Miami's 51-28, top seed. Celtics are 49-30, and the Bucks and Celtics Sixers are 48-30, so that second spot still up for grabs in the East. And with those teams having anywhere from 3 to 4 games left, the Heat with only 28 losses. Who do you like coming out of the East in the playoffs?
Well, I think Milwaukee's probably definitely still going to be in the finals. I don't think Boston has they are the second number two seed, but, I mean, they haven't had a lot of recent playoff success. I still think Milwaukee's going to be in the Eastern Conference Finals by the end of the year, but looking at Philadelphia and Brooklyn, I mean, if you look at the All-Stars Brooklyn has, I think if they're able to get out of the tournament, they might have a chance at some playoff success. I saw earlier today that Durant had basically blamed himself for the lack of success that they've had over the last part of the season because of his knee injury. If he's healthy and they've got Harden back too, I think they're going to be have a pretty good run coming into the playoffs. But Miami's always been a defensive team with their head coach, and I don't know. I think it would line up perfectly for Milwaukee and Miami to play in the Eastern Conference Final.
What'd you make of that almost fight between Eric Spoelstra, the head coach, and Jimmy Butler a couple of weeks ago from Miami? That was kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I heard about it. I didn't see it. I don't know. When you get into a position as a coach of a professional team, you're dealing a lot more with attitudes from grown men than you are college kids. College kids or even high school, it's a little bit easier to mold them and to get them to follow your leadership. But two adults and you're an adult leading an adult, it's a little bit easier to butt heads, I think, with in those types of situations. And it just, I don't know, he's always been kind of a player's coach too. And Jimmy Butler, I haven't really liked him much. Everywhere he's gone, he's had attitude issues. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think there needs to be something done about that in the NBA to give coaches more control over players.
Well, you've got to have control of the head coach. And you and I both know Spoelstra's done a good job in Miami. He's a good coach and a very good defensive coach. Then you have Pat Riley over him. So Miami generally plays very tough defense. They have pretty good depth. Been a little bit up and down this year, but it seems like they're playing better recently. I don't know if I picked them to come out of the East, but I think they'll be there towards the end. They may get to the Eastern Conference Finals. But Jimmy Butler has got to be on the same page as his coach and as a team. Because as he goes, the Heat goes. When they played the Lakers 2 years ago, he had a great playoff run and a great championship series. And he was tough to stop. That was Jimmy Butler at his best 2 years ago. He's had a lot of injuries. His play's been up and down this year. He's got to be healthy, got to be on the same wavelength as Spoelstra on the team because he's supposed to be their leader. And when you're a leader, you can't really be going after the coach. So we'll see if that becomes a problem in the playoffs. Okay, in the West, the Suns, without D-Book and Aiden, lost the other day, but they are still 62-16, the best record in basketball. They will be the top seed. They probably waited a long time since losing the NBA Finals last year. They were up 2-0 and lost to the Milwaukee Bucks. And so they've heard it all. Chris Paul's back. They've had some injuries during the course of the year to D-Book and Aiden and some of the other players. I think they're just ready to start the playoffs because, as you know, the NBA season is a marathon, and they really haven't been pushed this year. Golden State was actually on top of them early in the season. Then they had their share of injuries, and they became inconsistent. The Grizzlies have come on very strong. They're 55-23, second seed. That's secure. It's a battle between the third seed. The Warriors are 15-29, and the Mavericks at 49-30. As we head down the stretch, both teams with three games left in the season, the Warriors and the Mavericks. So who do you like coming out of the West, the Western Conference?
I still think it's going to come down to between Phoenix and Golden State. Phoenix has kind of shown the last couple years. It's kind of funny. All the talk was about Brooklyn and the three All-Stars, and now that's been broken up, and Brooklyn's going to be barely a playoff team. And, I mean, they may still be able to make a run, but Phoenix, outside of Chris Paul, I mean, they have a team full of basically players that not a lot of people have heard of, and it just kind of goes to prove that you don't need to have a team of all-stars to be successful in the NBA. Memphis, you go down the order, Golden State's really the only team in the West that's got an all-star rich lineup, and I mean, I still think they're going to be in the finals, but is Thompson going to be healthy enough from that knee surgery to lead him to the finals? I still think it's going to be Phoenix in the finals and either Miami or Milwaukee out of the East. But yeah, you look at the other teams in the Western Conference for the playoffs. That Golden State's really the only team that's got a lot of all-stars, and I mean, they could be in the final, but I don't think they're going to get to the NBA finals with the injuries they've had. I mean, this is their first or second year back in the playoffs. And after Thompson's injury, they've had some issues to their all-stars. And I think they need a few more years of playoff experience again back under their belt before they're going to be in serious contention to get back to the NBA finals like they did against Cleveland when LeBron was there.
I think Steph Curry's about 33. Draymond Green's been injured quite a bit this year. Then he's been thrown out of games since he came back. And you said about Klay Thompson, they'll have a great game, they'll have a bad game. That's to be expected, being away from 2 years. I'm not sure how his leg will hold up. Of course, you have Luka Doncic for Dallas, and you got Jokic with Denver, which is kind of like a fifth or sixth seed. But I think for Brooklyn, it's going to be tough for them to advance very far. When you got to go through the play-in games, win a couple there, then you're going to play the number one or number two seed in the East. Possibly that they could do something. I don't really expect it. I don't expect any team that wins the play-in tournament to even get past the first round. I think the top-seeded teams are too good for them. That's going the long route. They started that 2 years ago when the NBA was playing in the bubble, allowing teams, you know, to that play-in tournament because they said it was exciting for the fans. But I don't really see that happening. Durant's still a great player when he's healthy. That's always a problem. Kyrie's going to play all the games. But outside of that, Ben Simmons is not playing, and he should be. I guess he still has mental health issues. I mean, I thought they traded for him because he was going to play this year. He's not doing them any good. He's a great defensive player, but he doesn't bring a lot of offense. He certainly doesn't bring outside shooting ability. But that's strange. But I look at Phoenix to come out of the West. The thing about Phoenix, they're a very deep team. They're very deep, 9-10 deep. Now, D-Book hasn't played in all the games this year. He's had a fine season. Chris Paul missed a lot of time, but they still were able to win without those guys, sometimes with both of them out of the lineup because they have, you know, good backups. So they're a very deep team. There's nobody deeper than Phoenix. I think Miami's a pretty deep team. And the Bucks are reasonably deep, but they got that guy named Giannis, number 34, and he's tough for anybody to match up with. And that's Ayton's problem if Phoenix plays Milwaukee again in the finals. What's DeAndre Ayton going to do against Giannis? Because last year, he was intimidated by Giannis. He backed up and let Giannis take the ball to the rack over him, shoot from the outside. Nobody's going to stop Giannis, the Greek freak. But I think if you play against him, if you're Ayton, you have to score, kind of try to offset what he does. He's going to bring like 30 points and 12, 13 rebounds every game. If you're Ayton, you can't just go out there and score 8 points, get 5 rebounds. You got to do more than that. I think there's a guy 7 feet or 7'1". Giannis jumps well, but he's only 6'10". If you're 7'1", you can't let a 6'10 guy dominate you all the time underneath. I say if you're Phoenix, you got to take the ball right at him and try to get him into foul trouble if they do play. Like I said, you can't stop Giannis, and he's the reason why Milwaukee has a chance to come out of the East and win a title because of him. The other players are good, Middleton and Holiday, but he's really the key. He's such a dominant player. And that, like I said, Phoenix, you have him or McGee. You have Ayton or McGee that will try to guard Giannis if and when Phoenix plays Milwaukee. Now, so Phoenix has two guys, but kind of do a very good job. They're both seven-footers. They're not 6'9 guys, so we'll see. That's down the road. Trevor Beard, I want to ask you about what's going on with Damian Lillard. Is he going to continue playing for Portland? And what's happening with his injury situation?
He had stomach surgery in February, and I think they were just so far out of the playoffs then that he decided it wasn't worth coming back and risking any kind of serious damage from the injury. So he sat out the rest of the season. I think he's going to wait to see of moves they make in the off season. They need a starting caliber power forward. I think they're going to try to. I think they're probably going to make one draft pick, and then they have another draft pick from New Orleans in the McCollum trade, and a couple other picks. And it wouldn't surprise me if they package a pick and some other players to try to get another player via trade after the draft. But I think as far as starting power forward, I think they're probably going to draft somebody in the lottery this year.
You know, McCollum's been a godsend for New Orleans. He's played great for the Pelicans, McCollum.
Yeah, that's always been Portland's luck. Every time they they sign a player or draft a player in the lottery. I mean, going back to Michael Jordan, they had a chance to draft him, and they drafted Sam Bowie and broke his leg and had knee surgery, and that was it. And then you go back to Greg Oden. Same thing with it was either Greg Oden or Kevin Durant for the number one pick, Portland and Seattle. Last year, Seattle was in the NBA, I think, and Kevin Durant played 1 year for Seattle, and then the team moved to Oklahoma City, and we all know what happened between Kevin Durant and Greg Oden. Greg Oden played maybe 3 or 4 years with the Blazers, and he always had knee issues, was never really able to live up to the hype in college because of his knee issues. I don't even think he's playing basketball anymore, but yeah, I think they're probably going to try to draft a power forward in the draft this year. They've got other players around Dame that Anthony Simons, I think, is going to be kind of the next cream of the crop, next generation of NBA All-Stars. They're already talking about him taking over once Dame kind of gets towards the end of his career. And, I mean, you look at how long Dame's been with Portland. He's maybe got 5 years left tops on having a really productive career where he's able to score at the same clip he's been the last couple of years. And I think they've got to be a playoff team, though, next year. Otherwise, if they're not, I don't think he's going to put up with it much longer. There's been a lot of talk of Jody Allen, Paul Allen's sister that took over the team when he died. She also owned the Seahawks. And then you look at that head-scratching decision to trade Russell Wilson. There's kind of some decisions like that personnel-wise that she's made that have affected Portland too, that are kind of like, well, is her whole plan in doing this, is it really to try to get better in the draft, or is it to try to make the team more marketable to a possible buyer? So the only thing with that, though, is if they sold the team, would they stay in Portland? And almost everybody I've talked to says that the league would almost force them to stay in Portland because Portland's one of the most popular markets for the NBA, especially in basketball-only cities. That NBA is going to do everything they can to keep the Blazers in Portland because of their revenue and marketability with fans. The only thing is there's some lease issues that are coming up with the Rose Garden where the Blazers play that might come into effect if they do wind up selling the team. So hopefully they'll stay in Portland, but I think they've got to make the playoffs next year and probably do better than just where they've been the last couple of years as a 6-8 seed for Dame to stay with the team. And I think they've got to make a decent power forward signing or move through the draft to be a playoff team next year.
Make a splash. Trevor Beard, how can people get in touch with you? Trevor Beard from Westside Mobile Media.
People can get in touch with me through Facebook. I'm on Twitter at West Mobile Media, no E on the end of mobile, and then through Gmail, westsidemobilemedia@gmail.com.
Hey, Trevor, thanks for pinch hitting today. It was great talking to you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Take care, Trevor. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Talk to you later. And special thanks to Tom Hewitt, former Portland State broadcaster, now doing public address in Arizona. He's semi-retired. He was also a teacher in the Portland area for many years. His wife's from Oregon. Now they're in Arizona. So the weather's nice now until it gets a little hotter, and it will, just like here in the Valley, where I live in Bakersfield, Fresno, a place with a lot of great golf courses. And Arizona teams are getting better. Of course, the Phoenix Suns vying for an NBA title. They didn't get it done last year, and I think there's some pressure on them to hold the trophy this year. Arizona Cardinals had a fine season, but they kind of fell apart down the stretch. Diamondbacks were having their problems as far as baseball is concerned. And then Trevor Beard from Westside Mobile Media in Banks, Oregon, which is by Portland, Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest. Now, it's amazing. I talked about the fact that LA Dodgers catcher Will Smith was booed during spring training for having the same name as the actor who slapped comic Chris Rock at the Oscars before resigning from the Academy. The Major League Baseball player Will Smith then tripled after he was booed. Now, that was all done in good taste. And I thought it was funny when a couple of years ago when Will Smith of the Dodgers, the catcher, faced off against Will Smith of the Giants in a couple of games. So Will Smith against Will Smith, very common name. And those things don't happen very often, so that's really cool. Special thanks to my producer, Mark Mancini of Mancini Media. My name is Mark Heffernan. You can contact me by going to sportsratnet@yahoo.com or markheff20@gmail.com. God bless you. I will talk to you next week at 5 o'clock for Markman Madness here on Blog Talk Radio. Good night.